Welcome back on board the Starship. I'm talking to Mordib about his film 77 Ripple Effect and about his treatment since he's produced that film, because you've really been on a roller coaster over the last sort of 2 years with regards in and out of prison. And we were up to the point where you were preparing your case at Southwark Crown Court to defend the charge against you, which was trying to pervert the course of justice for sending DVDs. Now, just paint the scene for us, Mordib. What happened when you got into the court? I mean, was it full or?
Yeah, well, before we got actually into the courtroom, there were lots and lots of people outside in the corridor who came to support me. So many, in fact, that there weren't enough seats in the public gallery for all of them to come into the court. I think the public gallery holds something like 21. Mm-hmm. Some of them tried sitting two to a seat to try and squeeze in and get as many of them in as they could. But the authorities, you know, didn't really want anybody there, but they definitely didn't want more than the number of seats. So they were sort of looking to see if there were more people in. They wouldn't let them sit on the steps and things like that, even though they were perfectly quiet and all the rest of it. So what happened is that there were quite a few people outside, and there was a lovely atmosphere amongst them all, and what they would do is swap over. Some of the people who were sitting inside for a while would go outside to let others come
in. Right.
Was
so very, taking it in turns to have a watch of the trial.
Oh, yeah, yeah, which was very nice. Right. And they were there every day. The gallery was full, the public gallery was full to overflowing every day.
So you had a jury of 12 jurors, and a judge.
In this trial, it was just the judge, and then sitting down below in front of him as the clerk of the court.
Right.
And to the right-hand side, there is a machine, a recording machine, and there's a person whose job it is to record everything that happens in the court.
And then 12 jurors. Yeah.
And 12 jurors, yeah. Although I didn't have the 12 jurors on the first day.
Yes. We'll just discuss that now, because you actually presented essentially two defences against what's happened to you. The first was that you actually challenged the Crown's jurisdiction over you, because you believe that that the legal system does not have any power over you, and you're challenging that.
And the sovereignty of Elizabeth.
And the sovereignty of the monarch.
Yeah.
Now, that's a very... well, not complicated, but it's a subject which takes quite a lot of explaining, which we're going to touch on in another show. We're going to go into the monarchy and, you know, why the monarchy has its power and perhaps why the monarchy shouldn't have power. We're going to go into all of those issues. Mm-hmm. But that first day was you presenting that case. And just briefly to touch on that, you wanted to have a jury for that part of the case.
I did, yes. I explained to the judge that as I was challenging the jurisdiction and the sovereignty of the Crown, okay, that he couldn't possibly rule on that, because he could not be impartial, because he is employed by the Crown.
Yeah.
He swore at the judge's oath. The judge's oath, in the oath, they swear allegiance to the monarch.
Yeah.
So I was not only challenging her jurisdiction, the Crown's jurisdiction, I was also challenging his, because he gets his authority from them.
Yeah.
So it's a legal maxim that no man can judge in his own cause or in a cause to which he is a party. And he obviously was a party, because I was challenging his own jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And so I explained to him that it would not be fair and just for him to rule on it, that it needed to be, the challenge needed to be heard by an independent jury.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't give you a jury?
He refused to give me a jury to decide that issue. Decided that he was going to go ahead and put me on trial, and he was going to decide the jurisdiction, even though... I mean, that's a perversion of justice, because he could not possibly be impartial, and he wasn't impartial.
Now, you presented him a document which people can read from your website. We'll put that link on the screen. This was your challenge to the jurisdiction.
Yes.
Now, he then considered that overnight. Mm. And as I said, we'll discuss this in another show, but essentially it was what he said was a bit of a cop-out.
Absolutely. He ignored what I'd said in the document.
Yeah. But as I said,
because he couldn't argue against it.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. Nobody can. It's absolutely bulletproof, watertight, and ironclad. There's absolutely nobody can argue lawfully against it and win. So he ignored it.
And there was basically two prongs. We'll just stay on it for a second. There was two prongs to it. The first is that the Queen was coronated on a fake coronation stone.
Correct.
And the second is that that you believe that the Crown has committed treason and not followed the laws in the Bible.
Not followed the laws that she swore to maintain to maintain the utmost of her power at her coronation.
Right.
In her coronation oath.
And the judge...
And she's broken her coronation oath thousands and thousands of times, which means that if she breaks the oath or the contract is null and void, which means she's no longer the monarch.
Yeah.
And if she's no longer the monarch, she can't take me or anybody else to court.
Okay. Now, a lot of people would hear that and go, well, what you're going to have then? Anarchy. But we'll cover this in another show because it's a very, it's not a simple cut and dry issue,
the whole thing.
Isn't. No, it's and, but basically, the judge didn't really answer the second prong of that. He basically just said that the coronation stone is just a ceremonial thing. It doesn't matter that it might have been a fake stone. Mm. That's essentially what he said.
Yes.
Yeah. So he didn't dispute that the Stone of Scone was fake?
No, absolutely not. Right. He couldn't because I can prove it beyond any shadow of a doubt.
Right.
And well, he knew that.
Yeah. Right, so we...
But to just come back to the word anarchy, it is they who are the anarchists.
Okay.
Because they are making up their own rules.
Sure.
And they have no right to do that.
Okay. Now, we come on to the initial charge, which is you defending yourself against this charge of trying to pervert the course of justice, which ran on for 3 days.
Yeah.
And... one thing which was, I was very pleased to hear that you were allowed to show 7-7 Ripple Effect to the jury and to the judge. Yeah. So just tell us what happened when you showed the film.
They showed the film in its entirety to the jury, and then I went on the witness stand, and I prearranged with my barrister to ask me all the right questions so that I could get all of the information out, not only to the jury, to the court and to the jury, but also so it would all go down officially on court records. Mm-hmm. Because now it's been shown in the court and the trial was over, really, the contents of the film, so they had to show the film. So now the 7-7 Ripple Effect and its contents are actually on record with the court. Mm-hmm. Plus all the testimony that I gave. And my barrister asked me all the right questions that we'd prearranged so that I could explain how I originally started with all of this with 9/11 and how I knew on the day of 9/11 that it was an inside job because it was totally illogical the way the buildings came down, the burning
for a
long time.
So you actually managed to present evidence of 9/11 in this trial, which is quite a...
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of those pieces of evidence was the famous Jane Stanley clip where she reports that Building 7 has collapsed 25 minutes before it actually collapsed. And you actually pointed that out to the jury.
Yeah, after we'd they'd seen the film, I didn't stop it while it was running. They watched the film from start to finish. But then later on, whilst I was being giving my testimony from the witness box, I arranged for them to actually show that piece, that photograph that's in my film, of Jane Stanley standing in front of the windows announcing that the Salomon Brothers building, World Trade Building number 7, had fallen, and pointed out to the jury in the picture that you can see the building still standing over her left shoulder. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how did the BBC know at least 25 minutes in advance that that building was going to come down, and explain to the jury then that that proves we cannot trust the BBC, which is what I had already said in the film, in the 7-7 Ripple Effect, that the BBC is a government propaganda machine and it cannot be trusted. And that picture of Jane Stanley and explaining it, and stopping it, explaining it to the jury proves my point. That the BBC, how did they know that that building was coming down unless they were involved in some way in it and in the covering up of it? Mm-hmm. Because somebody at the BBC on the day of 7-7, which was the 5 o'clock news, as you may be aware of, as she was reporting, they said, we're going over to New York to our New York correspondent, Jane Stanley, And then she gives her speech, and they can see the building behind her. Mm-hmm. And then somebody at the BBC must have realised that knew New York, must have realised that was the building over her left shoulder. Mm-hmm. So the picture suddenly all went fuzzy.
Right.
And went off.
Right.
And then they
lost the satellite link. Yeah, that was the story.
That was the excuse. Yeah. Oh, sorry, we've lost the satellite link. But somebody must have realised.
Were you able to gauge any of the jury's reaction or even the judge's reaction as they're sitting watching your film? Is that?
Not really. For the 3 days that the jury were there, they were kind of all poker-faced. They wouldn't make eye contact with me.
Right.
And they were all straight-faced. So it was difficult. Whilst I was in the witness box, I got a different feeling from some of them. They sort of looked at me and you know, I thought, yeah, okay, these people are okay. Because I was concerned initially that the government might handpick the jury their people, mm-hmm. because they were desperate, you know, to get a conviction. Mm-hmm. But when I saw, you know, the attitude of some of them, I could see that they'd woken up. Mm-hmm. They'd realised from watching the film that all wasn't well.
Right. Yeah. Now, you explained to me the other day about the summing up of the various camps. Mm. The prosecution, the defence, and the judge.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that? What order was it first? Who sums up first?
The prosecutor sums up first, mm-hmm. and this was on the Thursday morning, the last day. And then the defence sums up. Mm-hmm. And then when they've done, the judge sums up. He tells the jury the points of law, and then does his summary of what's happened during the trial. Mm-hmm. And during the summing up of the prosecution, he sat there attentively listening to what the prosecutor had to say.
The judge did.
The judge did. Yeah. Yes. And then when she'd finished, and my defence started to sum up, he then started picking up papers and rustling them in front of his microphone and making as much noise and absolutely, totally ignoring what was happening in the court.
Right.
After having
it blatantly clear whose side he was on.
Oh,
basically.
Absolutely, yeah, right. Absolutely. And during his summing up, he did everything he could to convince the jury to find me guilty without actually ordering them to do it, which mm-hmm. he's not allowed to do. Mm-hmm. And
this is something which judges generally do. They direct the jury.
Yeah, yeah.
Juries would normally go with the judge.
Yes.
In normally.
Yeah, a lot of times I suppose they would, but they could see from the testimony that I gave from the witness box mm-hmm. that I was genuine and I was telling the truth and that I wasn't trying to pervert the course of justice. I was trying to prevent a miscarriage of justice by the government. And anyway, the judge in his summing up perverted the definition of the word pervert, because I was accused of attempting to pervert the course of justice, public justice, contrary to common law. Mm-hmm. And so he actually told the jury his definition of the word, or the legalese, because they have their own language.
Yeah.
They use our words, our English language, but they have different meanings.
Yeah.
For the words, so that when you go in court and they're using English words, you think you know what they're saying,
right.
and you don't, because the words that they use, it's a different language. It's called legalese, and they have a different meaning for the words that we use.
It's a bit of a knotty one, you know, perverting the definition of the word pervert.
Yeah, absolutely. So what he said, we all know, normal people who use the English know that the word pervert means to divert something from its rightful course. Okay. The judge said to the jury that the word pervert meant to influence.
Right.
Okay. So, and what he was trying to get them to understand was that if it was possible for my film to have influenced them mm-hmm. in any way, then I was guilty.
So he's trying to move the goalposts, basically.
Exactly, yeah. And he emphasized that. He repeated that three times throughout his summing up.
Okay. Right. Now,
desperate to try to get me convicted.
Okay, so that must have left you with a bit of a, you know, uncomfortable feeling when they went out to consider the verdict. Mm. You must have been that, watching the judge sum up in that way, must have really...
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because
the
potential sentence is...
Oh, 20 years is the maximum sentence. I could,
so,
and I'm sure they would have given... I mean, they probably wouldn't have given me 20 years, but I'm sure they would have given me the maximum they thought they could get away with.
Right.
To make an example of me and to punish me for having made the film and exposed the crimes that they committed. And to obviously to make an example of me to prevent anybody else from doing the same thing that I did. All the way along, I mean, this was a malicious prosecution. It was frivolous, it was a malicious prosecution, and it was politically motivated to punish me. It wasn't about me sending the film to the court, because that's lawful. You can do that. It's called an amicus curiae brief, which means a friend of the court brief. And that's the law, that anybody who's not a party to a trial, who has evidence that they consider is important to that trial, they can send it to the court, which is what I did, and then the court decides whether they're going to admit it into evidence and show it to the jury, or whether they'll just discard it. So what I did was perfectly lawful. Okay, so it wasn't really about me trying to pervert the course of justice. It was about using that as an excuse to punish me for what I did.
Sure.
Right, but right from the beginning, I knew that if there were any decent people left in this country, there was absolutely no way that they would be going to be able to get a conviction. But what they'd done is that they ruined 2 years, 3 months and 2 days of my life on virtual house, semi-house arrest with the bail conditions and all the rest of it. And in amongst that, I had spent 157 days actually in prison, in Ireland waiting for extradition, and then in Wandsworth waiting for the trial. But I, you know, I had the confidence that unless they had handpicked the jury, and unless there were no decent people left in this country, there was absolutely no way they could get a guilty verdict. But then, because of the judge's summing up and him, the way he explained and perverted the word, definition of the word pervert, three times to the jury, then I was wondering, well, you know, is the jury, are they going to see through this? Or not, or are they going to go with, you know, are they going to go with what the judges said? And so, you know, at that point I wasn't too sure, because it was possible that, you know, they had handpicked some of the jury or all of the jury. And so until they actually came in to give their verdict, you know, and had given it, I wasn't really 100% sure of which way it was going to go. But whichever way it went, you know, I did the right thing. They would have to put me in prison for having done the right thing.
How long did they take to consider?
About 3 hours, I think, something like that, something around about 3 hours, or 4 hours.
So,
and
tell us what happened.
Well, whilst the jury were out deliberating, then all the friends in the supporters in the public gallery and myself, we went down to the cafe. There, and there's a tannoy system, and then they say, you know, everybody who's taking part in this particular trial must come back to the courtroom. So I went back to the courtroom. I went back into the goldfish bowl, into the dock behind the screen and all of that, locked in there. And the jury came back in. And then the clerk of the court stood up and asked the jury forewoman if they'd reached a verdict. And she said, yes, they had. And he said, well, can you tell us what the verdict is? And she had a big beaming smile on her face, and she was obviously very, very glad to be able to give the not guilty verdict.
Okay.
And she hadn't smiled for the whole time of the trial. None of them had really, but she was absolutely beaming, smiling when she gave the not guilty verdict. Was very, very happy to do so. And so then the judge said that the jury could be dismissed, and among a few other things, and then that the jury could be dismissed, and thanked them for having, you know.
And I heard that I was told by Nick and others that the court just erupted.
As soon as the jury stood up to leave the courtroom, the public gallery erupted, and they were cheering and applauding the jury, and so the jury left to a standing ovation, basically. And at that point, they all did look at me as they were going out, and I thanked them all individually for for the verdict that they'd given. And it was a lovely atmosphere.
Right.
The judge was really not happy at all, and disappeared out the back while everybody's clapping and doing.
Right.
He shot him. Yeah.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add, Mardib?
I'd just like, if they come, or even if they don't, if they just watch this film, I'd like to thank them again for doing
the jury.
Right, yes, the jury, for doing the right thing and coming in with the not guilty verdict.
Well, let's hope some of them are watching.
Yeah. And I'd also like to say that if none of the jury were aware, if they were all, you know, like most of the nation, if they were asleep to what's really going on, before they saw the film and took part in the trial, then I managed to wake up, because it was a majority verdict. It has to be at least 10 to 2 for a majority verdict. It wasn't unanimous. Then if none of them had a clue beforehand, I managed to wake up 10 out of 12 of them. And if we can do that on a national scale by getting the truth out through your films and other people's films and radio interviews, we can get the truth out to the nation. You know, 10 out of 12 is 83%. If we can do the same with the nation, then we've won. And we can start to put things right and bring the real culprits to justice.
Absolutely.
Which is what this is really all about, and which is what I've been striving for all along.
Absolutely. And with regard, we're sitting here in North London. Do you have plans to go back to Ireland? Is that?
I should be going back.
You will be going back, yeah?
I still have a place.
And I've heard you mention a possible 7-7 or a Ripple effect to perhaps tell some of this story. Is that something that you will look at?
Yes, I'm considering either doing a 7-7 Ripple Effect Director's Cut, which will be an extended version, or doing a Ripple Effect 2. I'm not quite sure which format to do yet, and I'm not really quite sure. I've got to sit down quietly on my own, perhaps back in Ireland, where I'm peaceful and not being disturbed, and think about and the script and the plot for it, and then probably I'm going to make one.
Okay, Mardib, thanks very much for being interviewed again. And I'd just like to appeal to the family members of victims of the 7-7 atrocity, because I think if you watch this interview with Mardib, I can vouch for him. I trust him 100%. So we are looking to get some contact with victims of 7-7 and get their stories on tape, because Mardib wants a public inquiry, I want a public inquiry, and many of the families want a public inquiry. Thank you.